The Tom Woods Show, episode 1583.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, when you criticize the Federal Reserve, you get all these lackey-style responses. Why, the Fed has made the economy more stable. You don't want to go back to the 19th century, do you? All kinds of arguments like that. Well, you can blow those and others out of the water with my free ebook, Our Enemy, the Fed. Grab it at ourenemythefed.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. It's pretty darn late at night on February 3rd, 2020. The night of the Iowa caucuses, and we do not know who the Democratic victor is. Obviously, Trump was victorious on the Republican side. We don't know who the Democratic victor is because of some kind of weird technical problems with the voting. So I can't comment on that. I need to get the episodes recorded so that my poor suffering audio team can get them in shape to send them out. So maybe by the time you're hearing this, you'll know who the winner was, but here I am with a microphone in front of me, and I got to say something. So instead, I'm going to do something that is timely in its own way, in that I happen to like centenaries. I like 100-year anniversaries of things. So when we got to 2014, I did a World War I week on the Tom Woods Show, where we talked about the 100-year centenary of the beginning of World War I. I guess that's a redundancy, but it doesn't matter. Point is, we did that. Then in 2018, we did 100 years since the end of the war and so on. Well, it's 100 years since Ludwig von Mises, the great economist, wrote his article, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, 1920. Very important article. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/1583. And you may think that it's difficult to read because Mises, in some of his advanced writings, can be challenging for some people. Some of his popular writings are quite simple, almost too simple, but you may think that this article on socialism is going to be too technical, but you can understand it. It's actually not especially challenging, but it was very influential. It provoked debate at the time, and it continues to be discussed and talked about in Austrian economic circles to this day. And obviously, I'm not talking about the country of Austria, but the Austrian School of Economics, which is a school of thought. And Mises said in that article that a socialist economy is impossible. And I think people didn't quite understand what he meant by that. So I want to talk about that, where that's coming from, what he actually meant by that. What he in effect means is that economizing in the socialist commonwealth is impossible. That is, taking scarce resources and applying them to their most value-productive ends. That certainly is impossible because you have no way of doing it. You cannot carry out that task. So it having been 100 years since then, I thought this might be an opportune moment to revisit that important article. Now, we've talked about economic calculation and the problems with socialist economic calculation at least several times on this podcast over the years, but it's been rather a while. And it couldn't hurt to have a bit of an overview of it. And then I want to talk about its continuing relevance, because, of course, today it's hard to find places where the private ownership of the means of production is absolutely forbidden and has been absolutely abolished. So how could this alleged problem still persist? And I want to suggest that it's still relevant to us. It just appears in different forms today. So here's how I try to explain this to general audiences. I think subconsciously we have this, maybe that's not the word I'm looking for. I think a lot of people have this gut instinct that some kind of central planning, whether it's one person or a committee of people deciding on things like what should be produced and where and in what quantities and who should work where and what the hour should be, and all these various questions. If we have people planning this all out, this will yield us a better result than if we just let everybody do whatever they want. Because everybody doing whatever they want, surely that must lead to a chaotic result. Whereas if we have a clearly articulated plan for the economy that is laid out by experts and then handed down to society to be carried out surely that has to give us a more orderly, predictable, rational result. It turns out that the truth is exactly the opposite. It's counterintuitive in a way. Because you can understand, I can certainly understand why somebody who hasn't given the matter much thought might think that indeed, of course, you're going to get a better result if people coordinate and plan. But it turns out, as I say, the opposite is true. The more you centrally plan, the less order there is and the more chaos there is. Now, why would that be? So now we move into explaining Mises' argument, and then we'll be able to see what the problem with this is. In the socialist commonwealth, as conceived of by Karl Marx, there would be no private property in the means of production. Now, when socialists say they are against private property in the means of production, they don't mean they are against private property in personal goods like mouthwash or ballpoint pens or envelopes or chess sets or whatever. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about they want to abolish private property in the means of production. The means of production are those things that are used in the production of consumer goods. So private property in the means of production means privately owned factories, banks, natural resource endowments, all these sorts of things. The capital goods that are used to facilitate production, assembly line equipment, all these sorts of things are to be privately owned. In a market economy, they'd be privately owned. But in the socialist commonwealth, they are instead, well, if not owned by the state, which is how in practice it always worked out, then somehow collectively owned, not privately owned by an identifiable private owner. And the trouble with this is that if there's no private property in the means of production, then there can be no prices for the means of production. These capital goods can have no prices. Now, why is that? Well, how are prices determined? Prices are determined through the interaction of buyers and sellers. And we can see this very clearly in the case of an art auction. There you have only one seller, so that simplifies the case. And we see that the price is determined by the highest bidder. Whoever places the highest bid wins, and that becomes the selling price of the item. Now, when you have multiple sellers, this changes the dynamic because as we are implicitly placing bids in the marketplace, you have sellers who are prepared to sell at lower bids than others are. And eventually this interaction yields you the price system. Now, you can read about the determination of prices in a great deal of the Austrian literature and in Bumbavrick, for example, and that's not my purpose here. Now, let's just stipulate for the sake of argument that prices are determined through the interaction of buyers and sellers. And what we get are objective, is something objective, namely prices from this process. But there are no prices in the socialist commonwealth for the means of production, for capital goods and the like, because there's no buying and selling, because they're all owned by the same owner. They're either owned by the state or they're owned by the community, whatever that means. They're all owned together, owned by one entity. That's the point. So since they're all owned by one entity, how could there be any buying or selling? One entity already owns them all, so there's nothing to buy, and the entity isn't going to sell the property to like private owners, because the whole point of the system is not to have private owners. So there's no buying or selling of these things. And if there is no buying or selling, there are no bids or counter bids or offers that eventually ossify into prices. So prices are not determined for these things. They have no prices. Therefore, without prices, entrepreneurs cannot assess the relative profitability of different courses of action. They can't appraise the situation properly because they're dealing with completely incommensurable goods. I mean, in the abstract, how do you compare steel with lumber? Purely in the abstract, such that you could put a number on one of them. You couldn't. That would make no sense and it would be impossible. There's, you know, steel is not simply, you know, let's say a 3 times stronger version of lumber. That's not what steel is. Steel is a qualitatively different thing. So how can you compare steel with lumber? Well, you can't unless you have a price system that gives you an objective number that's placed on these things. So for example, I'm an entrepreneur. I want to produce some product. So I'm building a physical plant and I have all these capital goods inside that physical plant that help to produce that product. But I'm trying to decide which capital goods to use, or how many of them, what kinds, what inputs should I use, and to make all these determinations, or also where should I locate my physical plant. To make these determinations, I need prices. I need to be able to assess the potential relative profitability of different courses of action. If I use this resource, it's going to cost me a lot more than if I use that resource. And then after I go through the production process and I have consumer goods that I sell to the general public and I earn revenue from those sales, I would be able to look at those sales figures, the revenue figures, and compare them to the prices I paid for all the inputs that went in to produce those goods. And I could see if I had made a profit or made a loss. I would just compare how much I earned for producing the product to how much I spent in the course of producing the product. So my earnings, my inputs, I can evaluate these things, engage in what's called economic calculation. That's how entrepreneurs operate in a market economy, through the profit and loss system. And as they earn profits, they tend to expand. And as they suffer losses, they contract. And that feedback, that profit and loss feedback mechanism, in effect, tells entrepreneurs more or less what to do if they want to be prosperous. And sometimes the best thing they can do is to close entirely because they keep making losses, which means that they're producing goods that aren't worth as much as the stuff they're inputting to produce them in the first place. So they're actually destroying value by producing those goods. The losses that they suffer are society's way of saying, stop doing that. You're misallocating resources. There are other actors in the economy that can put those goods to more value-productive uses than you can. Profit and loss calculation can also tell a firm whether in their overall profitability they might still be making losses in some particular departments. So a bakery, maybe the bakery is making all its profits from cakes and it's losing a fortune in bread, or pastries are losing a lot of money for them. They look at profit and loss. They look at the inputs that they had to expend to produce the product, and then they look at the amount of money they earned selling the product. They compare the two, and they have a sense of what's going on. And so they might want to expand their production of cakes and contract their production of other things. They could not know exactly what was going on here if they didn't have prices for the inputs, for the means of production, because then they'd have nothing to compare their sales revenues to, and therefore nothing on the basis of which they could determine if they had earned a profit or suffered a loss. So in this environment, of course, there is obviously no way to economize. There is no way to make sure that resources are being directed to their most value-productive uses. And incidentally, of course, the fact that in a market economy, some good that I might want to use in my production process costs a lot of money, and it's tricky for me to be able to use it. Maybe I have to use a less expensive substitute. That is basically the economy's way of saying this particular good is urgently needed elsewhere. And if you don't absolutely have to have it, don't even bother trying to get it, because you're going to probably go out of business trying to afford it. That's the economy's way of saying we need it more urgently than you do. It's to make sure that it's not wasted on a production process that could easily use substitutes, or that is not, whose finished product is not as highly valued by consumers as that of another product that therefore needs this input more urgently. There's no way for that to happen in a socialist economy. There's no way for some industry to be able to pull resources away from industries that don't need them as urgently and pull them toward themselves. There's no way for that to happen, because there's no pulling, because all the resources are all owned in one big pile by some community or the state that already owns them and is going to allocate them on a completely arbitrary, non-economic, and probably purely political basis. All right, let me take just a minute, though, before I continue this. And by the way, I hope you're following me. This is like 3 o'clock in the morning. I need to get this done because I want the episode to be in the Dropbox folder so that when Chris wakes up in the morning to do the episode for me, it's sitting there. And I could either do it now before I go to bed, or I could wake up at the crack of dawn in a few hours, and then I would be completely incoherent. But anyway, I want to take a quick minute. It is the year 2020, and I think a lot of people by the year 2020 were predicting that we'd have colonies on Mars, and we'd have flying cars, stuff like that. A lot of people get these predictions wrong. Most people got them wrong. And the truth is, we'll always get the future wrong, which is why we need to get what? Life insurance right. And that's where Policy Genius can help. Policy Genius makes finding the right life insurance a breeze. I've used it myself. It is super simple. In minutes, you can compare quotes from the top insurers to find your best price. You could save $1,500 or more a year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and red tape. And it's not just life insurance that Policy Genius makes easy. They can also help you find the right home and auto insurance or disability insurance. So if your science fiction dreams for 2020 still haven't become science fact, don't get discouraged. Get life insurance like a responsible person. It takes just a few minutes to find your best price and apply at policygenius.com. Policy Genius will always get the future wrong. Better get life insurance right. I've sometimes used this example because it involves a good that everybody can recognize is valuable and important, namely customer service. Every business has to deal with customer service. So, you know, let's say you've got a department store. You're always going to have customer service people there. So the question is, how many customer service people should you have? Well, obviously, you can't know that in the abstract. I mean, nobody listening to this should be shouting, at the podcast, seven, because obviously there are many factors you need to know about, you know, how big is the department store and, how much traffic does it get and what's the percentage of people who tend to complain or what? I mean, you know, you have to at least know those basic things. But then beyond that, you have to know, well, let's see, how much would we have to pay? What's the going rate for a customer service person? How much do we have to pay them so they don't go work for somebody else instead? So we got to factor all that in. And how much do we lose if we don't have enough customer service? So with something like customer service, you would think, well, the more customer service, the better, right? There's a good where it's just the more, the better. But that can't be true. Because obviously, if a firm had one customer service agent for every single customer, that's obviously too much. That is a misallocation of labor because there are obviously more urgent things for those laborers to be doing elsewhere in the economy, producing things we need more urgently than to be the customer service agent for just one customer at a time, given that most customers don't even need customer service. It's obviously a waste to have one customer service agent for every single customer. That would be too much customer service. But obviously, having your entire customer service be a tape recording of an answering machine message. And by the way, that was a deliberate throwback to the old days, tape recording. Obviously, that would be far too little customer service. So we know the answer of what's the optimal amount, let's say, of customer service is somewhere in between. But how are you going to know what it is without profit and loss, without looking at how much customer service people cost you, and then running some tests, just seeing how profitable you are with a customer service team of this size, or this size. And eventually you'll reach a size that is as optimal as you can get it in this veil of tears, you know, in this imperfect world. Because again, if you use too much customer service, not only are you losing money, but remember that you losing money is the rest of the economy's way of saying you're misallocating resources. We need those laborers more urgently over here in the production of houses or something than you need them to be giving massages to everybody who walks into the store and whatever. That's obviously a misuse of resources. But if there's no price on these laborers, if there's no price, then you can't calculate profit and loss. And yeah, for all you know, maybe just the more the better. I mean, you don't know. You have no way of figuring this out. And given that customer service seems like obviously a good thing to have, I mean, you might think that this isn't even a problem for calculation, just have as many as you can have. But obviously, you get to a point where it's too many. So you don't want too many, you don't want too few. There's no non-arbitrary way to determine this other than by trial and error using the profit and loss system. And incidentally, it's not correct to think of the situation as we have central planning in a socialist commonwealth and we have utter chaos in a market economy. We have individual plans in a market economy. All the individuals have their own plans, their own goals, their own aspirations that they're trying to pursue. And you might think, well, if there isn't the one overall or overarching goal for all of society to meet together, then it's going to be chaotic. Well, it turns out, no, that what winds up happening thanks to the price system is that we coordinate all our plans together. So for example, let's think of a firm that's trying to decide where it should locate. You might think it should locate right next to the building where its suppliers are located. That would be great because then the supplier can just basically walk the supplies over to them and they can save money on transportation. So they say, we're going to build our plant here, you know, right here next to this building, next to where our supplies are produced. But maybe there are many other people in society that urgently need that plot of land for something that the consumers value even more. They need that plot of land. And so they bid up the price of that plot of land to a price where you can't afford it. That's the economy's way of coordinating plans. Because your plan of putting your firm there, your business there, conflicted with the plans of these other people. And somehow we have to figure out, well, who's going to get to do it? And the answer is whoever pleases the consumer more. Whoever produces what the consumer wants at an affordable price more effectively will get that spot. So it may turn out that it's more profitable for me to take my physical plant and locate it 15 miles away. And you'd think, see, if we didn't have prices, this wouldn't occur to us. We'd say, well, of course, I want to be right next to this building. But when suddenly you look at the price of the land next to that building and it's so high, that's the rest of the economy's way of saying, we really need this land. If it's, I mean, you could find theoretically somewhere else to go, then you better go ahead and do that. So maybe this guy moves away 15 miles, and even though he now has to use trucking services to get his supplies, the land 15 miles away is so much cheaper that he can more than afford the transportation cost. But again, how could he evaluate this? So it turns out that it's counterintuitive. He should actually be farther away from his suppliers, and he'd be more profitable. How would he know that if he had no prices in the means of production? He had no prices in the trucking services, and he had no way to compare the different cases of being located here as opposed to over there. How could he decide which one was the more profitable alternative? Of course, he'd have no way of doing it. So now imagine an entire economy where all these decisions are completely arbitrary because there is no economic calculation and profit and loss mechanism guiding. And let's not forget also that entrepreneurial foresight is only activated by having a personal monetary stake in the outcome. No central planner has any monetary stake in the outcome of his decisions. It doesn't matter to him if his decisions are absurd and not very well considered or thought out. He suffers in no way. He's not risking his own capital. So entrepreneurial foresight is not thereby activated. So you have that problem too in the socialist commonwealth. So how does this apply today? I mean, we don't have a lot of societies in the world where private property and the means of production is absolutely abolished. It's curtailed in some places. It's heavily taxed in some places. So how does this still apply today if it's not, it may be taxed, it may be harassed in some way, but it's not absolutely abolished in most places. It still applies in that every state, whether a socialist one or not, struggles with the economic calculation problem. Because although the state, like for example, let's take the federal government in the United States, the federal government does have prices of the means of production at its disposal, has prices of everything at its disposal. So that's different from the socialist commonwealth. But it does not have a profit and loss mechanism. And in that way, it resembles the socialist commonwealth. It doesn't have profit and loss because there is no feedback mechanism for it to determine whether it's doing things well or badly. Nobody voluntarily hands over money to the state. So it's not a case where people are voluntarily indicating they want this or that service, they want this or that product. The money is just seized from them in the form of taxation. So that does not tell the state what people want and what quantities of it they want and what they're willing to give up to get it and all that. They don't know anything. They're completely acting in the dark. Everything is arbitrary and political. It is not based on consumer demand, intensity of consumer demand, anything like that. So they're necessarily arbitrary. How do they know, for example, how many customer service people there should be at the DMV? How could they possibly know that? The general public has to deal with the DMV no matter what, and there is no competition for the DMV. So they're going to keep on coming back no matter how incompetent the place is, no matter how few people are working there, no matter how incompetent the people who are working there are, none of that even matters because the general public has no choice. They're forced to do this. And because they're forced to do it, they're not engaged in what we would call a voluntary transaction. They're not choosing to buy something. And so the money they spend on state services, in effect, in other words, the amount of taxes they pay, doesn't tell the state anything other than people will let you take their money if you threaten them. So for every single thing the state does, it is operating completely in the dark. So when it runs the police, well, how many police officers should we have? Should we have one police officer for every American? Obviously not. Should we have no police officers at all? Obviously not. So what's the amount we should have? Well, the state can only make arbitrary determinations of this because they don't have any profit and loss mechanism to help them decide. And so when we do have a police force, well, what should they be doing? Should they spend most of their time monitoring speed on the highway? Should they be spending their time solving murders? Should they be? How do they allocate labor for each of these particular tasks? Again, totally arbitrary. And so the long and the short of it is, the more, and I realize that police, it's hard to, you know, visualize the private sector doing that, but it can. It's just hard for somebody to visualize it. But the point remains, there's no non-arbitrary way of deciding how to assign tasks to everybody on that force. Because which tasks do people demand the most? You know, which ones provide the most value? Well, you have no idea because you don't have paying customers. You don't have competitors that people could go to who are offering them different types of services. So they don't know. They have no way of knowing how many people should be allocated here, how many people allocated there. So what you get necessarily with state involvement in the economy is a use of resources that is not consistent with what would have been used by free people. And the state just does not know what needs to be produced, created, offered, and they don't know what the intensity of demand for these sorts of things would be, how much of it to produce. It's totally arbitrary. How much of some government service should be produced, whether it's military activity or whatever, how much? Of course, there is no answer. What instead you get are political answers. You don't get economic answers. You get political answers. We're going to have this many resources devoted to this thing because I have a favorite constituency that wants that thing, so that's why we're getting it. That's how politics organizes society, whereas the market is constantly dealing with feedback from the public, constantly trying to perfect itself the best it can in response to consumer demand. So that, I hope, gives you the basic gist of, first of all, Mises' socialist calculation problem. There's no way to calculate profit and loss in a socialist commonwealth because without prices and the means of production, you have no way to evaluate the difference between how much you spent on the inputs into your production process and how much you earned selling the goods created in that process. You have no way to evaluate these two things because there are no prices for your inputs, so you can't tell if you're doing well or you're doing badly. And so you're making decisions that in all likelihood are not economic. They are not allocating resources to their most value productive end. And so an entire economy organized like that, where all these bad decisions are made because, well, everybody's operating in the dark. How could they make better decisions? Eventually leads to a catastrophic outcome. It has to. So that is Mises' article, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. You can check it out at tomwoods.com/1583. All right, so that will indeed do it for today. Let me tell you about Revolution on a Recliner at revolutiononarecliner.com. Well, this is just a fun site and podcast for libertarians. The way the gentleman who runs it describes it, if it were possible to create a Frankenstein that was in part John Stossel, Tony Soprano, Thomas Jefferson, and Homer Simpson, well, that would be John Conrad, the creator of this site. His episodes range from politics to comedy to random absurdities. He's got some great blog posts on all kinds of topics of relevance to libertarians, from the deep state to what fairness really means, critiques of so-called woke people, Rand Paul fighting against Lindsey Graham. There's all kinds of interesting stuff that I think you guys will enjoy. So very much worth checking out, revolutiononarecliner.com, another website created by a listener of the Tom Woods Show who got his hosting through my special link and therefore got some nice publicity for himself, as well as membership in my private bloggers group and other great goodies. So if you'd like some great goodies to help you promote your forthcoming website or blog, before you get your hosting, make sure and check out my special deal where I'll help you get some publicity right off the bat over at tomwoods.com/publicity. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.